Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On this episode, we'll hear a presentation by John Nichols, journalist with The Nation magazine and co-author with Robert McChesney of the book The Death and Life of American Journalism. But now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The Obama administration last week named the first two winners in the $4 billion plus race to the top. The bizarre contest pits the states against each other to determine which states are willing to be most ruthless in stripping away teachers' union rights and shutting down public schools to make way for charter schools. Delaware and Tennessee won a total of $600 million. Round two of the diabolical competition begins in June. With their mad race to the top, President Obama and his education hatchet man, Arne Duncan, have imposed corporate morality and operational methods on American public education. Nowhere in this model is there a place for unions, and nowhere is there a place for anything resembling community control. Public education is reduced to a marketplace for exploitation by cutthroat capitalists. The awesomely destructive process is called education reform, but looks and smells very much like disaster capitalism. In New Orleans, school privateers welcomed Hurricane Katrina as a kind of divine wind that virtually swept away public education, replacing it with a system that is almost entirely charter schools. In New York City, where a judge halted the closing of 19 mostly black and Latino schools, mass conversion to charter schools is leading to increased racial and economic segregation, an outcome confirmed on a national scale in a study by the UCLA Civil Rights Project. In Detroit, education reform means shutting down 44 public schools and replacing them with 70 new charter schools. Public school activists warn that private foundations plan to convert 75% of Detroit schools to charters within the next 5 years, moving the city closer to the New Orleans model without the need of intervention from a hurricane. It is, therefore, appropriate that the latest challenge to the Obama administration's assault on public schools is centered in Detroit, headquarters of the organization called BAM, By Any Means Necessary. BAM heads up a national coalition that will converge on the U.S. Education Department in Washington on April 10th under the banner, Our Children Are Not For Sale. Education Secretary Arne Duncan, say the organizers, plans to create a national network of 5,000 publicly financed, privately run, minimally regulated charter schools. The $4 billion race to the top competition is just the bait for the planned big switch. The race is the cruelest kind of contest, creating a mad scramble to abandon all tried and true reforms to get desperately needed federal funding and the insane competition of school against school, state against state. According to BAM activists, if Arne Duncan were a Republican, every progressive force in America would be demanding his resignation or firing. For any real pro-student educational reforms to occur, Duncan must go now. But of course, Duncan is not a loose cannon. He's Barack Obama's basketball buddy from Chicago, where Duncan closed black and brown schools and fired black teachers with abandon. when demonstrators gather at the Department of Education on Saturday, April 10th, they will be denouncing Arne Duncan, but the policies are Barack Obama's. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a presentation by John Nichols, journalist with The Nation magazine and co-author with Robert McChesney of the book The Death and Life of American Journalism. John Nichols spoke at 57th Street Books in Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood on Thursday, March 4th, 2010.
The best ways to frame this is actually to take a moment and honor somebody who passed away yesterday. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that when you're 96 years old, your death is not necessarily a shock. But Michael Foote, who was the great labor activist, founder of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and you know, just one of the most brilliant people ever in politics, leader of the Labour Party at its darkest and toughest days in England, also one of the great writers and literary scholars. And from those days, you know, before Obama, it used to be a punchline where you'd say, you know, it's when politicians could actually write books. Now we know that even in America they can now and again. Michael Foote passed away yesterday at the age of 96. Remarkable fella. And the reason that I bring him up is that before he was a member of parliament and a leader of the Labour Party in England, he was a journalist, and he was a working journalist. And he did one of the most important things that any journalist ever can do. In fact, really, it's the whole point of the thing. And that is, during World War II, when Winston Churchill, who was not all that great a guy, when Winston Churchill decided that the media coverage of the war effort was not chipper enough, not on board enough. Now, I know that's a foreign concept for many of you, right? I mean, we'd never have that happen in America, where they would say you got to be on board for the, you know. But when Churchill started cracking down on the Daily Mirror, which was one of the major tabloids in London, Michael Foote was the head editor, top editor, at the age of 28, of the Evening Standard, which was a rival newspaper. And for a variety of reasons, the Evening Standard had a great relationship with the government. And so Foote could have just stepped back and said, whoa, tough for the Daily Mirror, you know, it's good for me. Instead, he went to, in a very public forum, and in a remarkable thing, because this is 1942, the speech is still online. In fact, I recommend if you take away anything from tonight, in addition to the three or four copies of our book that you will be buying this St. Patrick's Day gift, perhaps. If you take away anything tonight, Google Michael Foote and Freedom of the Press, and you will see this amazing speech in which Michael Foote says to an audience in London, says, the liberty of the press in this country can only be maintained by the vigilance of the people and the vigilance of the parliament and the courage of the newspapers themselves. That's the only way. Therefore, we must fight, fight, fight to retain those liberties. It is the only way that we will retain democracy. It is the only way that we will retain democracy. Now, Foote was an Englishman, and I have no truck with Englishmen. I'm an American. We fought a revolution against those guys. But he did get that right. He figured that one out. Because there is no way, and I want to underline that, put a circle around it, exclamation marks after. There is no way that you can have democracy without journalism. It is absolutely, fundamentally impossible. And the founders of the American experiment actually understood that. Now, they were unbelievably imperfect men. And we are not in the, you know, this country was founded by, you know, heroic warriors, blah, blah, blah crowd. They were men of their moment. They made terrible mistakes. But the one thing they were was believers in the Enlightenment. They were products of an Enlightenment moment. That's what made them believe that perhaps you could become the ruler of a country without having had your mom or dad be the ruler of the country. Because that was how it was. Divine right of kings, it was mom or dad. Or you could raise an army and take out somebody else whose mom or dad was the ruler. But that's the only way you got in charge. These men of the Enlightenment had a theory. And that was that if you gave power to the people, they could choose better leaders. Now, let's be clear, they didn't give enough power to enough people. But they began a process, as Martin Luther King Jr. said. They set the template that could be followed upon. And their concept was that the only way that the people would ever be able to govern themselves, that they would have even the barest minimum of governing authority, was if they were fully informed. If the people had as much information as those who govern them. Because if you concentrate information, if you give control of information to an individual, to a group of individuals, to a group of, five or six corporations, if you do that and you allow them to frame the discourse, to shape the debate, they will shape it to reinforce their power. Kings had done that forever. It was not the British military, which I would note our guys beat. It was not the British military that maintained the power of the colonial empire. It was the control of information, the control of the discourse, both within England and beyond its borders, that allowed kings, and in other countries, kaisers and czars and potentates and whatever you wanted them to be called, to, through superstition, fantasy, lies, hold it, I'm thinking of Bush here. I'm getting a Bush moment. But through all of these things, to maintain the facade of their superiority and thus their control. So these gentlemen of the Enlightenment, when they founded this country, had a notion. And that was that we had to have not just the promise of free press, not that rosy terminology, but the reality of a free press, a diverse, challenging, dissenting, radical press. And remember, they were men of the Enlightenment. So to their mind, radical ideas were good. They might disagree with radical ideas. They might even fail to live up to them. But they actually believe, this notion is completely out of sync with where we are today, that you might be born with one set of ideas and learn things along the way and die with another set of ideas. And the ideas that you learn might be better than the ones you were born with. We might evolve in a lifetime to something better. And so they knew you had to have this robust, wild, wide-open free press that would work for all, at least, of those who would be participating in the democratic process. You couldn't have a democratic process without it. So we take, for our book, two quotes from those olden days. One of them is from James Madison, who's about this tall, very small man. He spent a lot of time thinking. He and his wife, Dolly, who made some very good cakes. And in fact, who everyone agrees is the only reason that he ever became president. You know I'm not going to tell that joke. But anyway, let's just be clear that having the good wife is always a very important thing in these times. But Madison was a good thinker, worried a lot about whether the whole experiment was going to work out. He was the primary author of the Bill of Rights. Said, a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce, or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. The power which knowledge gives. Arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives. Now, was James Madison saying, everybody ought to go, they shouldn't be at 57th Street Books tonight, they should be sitting at home in front of the internet for about 6 or 7 hours, trying to figure out the answer to every question, reading everything on the internet, which would probably take 8 hours, right? A long time. Reading every bit of information on the internet so that they could make their own decisions, that they could be their own governors, that they had to read every book, they had to... No. If you read Madison's writing, what he was saying is, arm yourselves with the power that knowledge gives. Assure that you have a media system in your republic that provides you with sufficient information to govern yourself. That you send journalists out there. There's no such thing as a professional journalist. There's no such thing as some honorable, like, elite. No, journalists are citizens who have been given the resources to spend a day researching and looking into things and then come back and give information to their fellow citizens so that those citizens can govern. Somebody has to farm. Somebody has to work in a bookstore. Somebody has to teach in a college. Somebody has to be a labor reporter. And that labor reporter is going to come back and tell them all the things, hopefully, that they might use to govern themselves. Journalism, founders understood, absolutely essential to the whole experiment. So that's the one thing. The other quote from Mr. Endicott, you can't do it, right, without the Jefferson quote. It's always the rule. So Jefferson, he said, I hold that a little rebellion now and again is a good thing, and as necessary in the political world as in the physical. A little rebellion now and again. Was Jefferson talking about a tea party? Although I don't think he minded. People get mad. I think Jefferson was glad that anybody got mad at the government. And anyway, that was all to the good. But he wasn't talking about a tea party. He wasn't talking about wearing some tri-corner hat and, you know, getting a pitchfork and screaming about something. No. Jefferson, it's very, very clear in all of his writings, he was conscious that they were imperfect men. Jefferson, more than any of the others, knew how flawed they were. He knew that he would be remembered as much for his flaws as his strengths, because he was a weak man. Brilliant man, but too weak to do the right thing in many ways. So he always was saying, look, there's the possibility of redemption for a human being and for a republic is in the revisiting of the outlines of the experiment, the constant return to the question of, are we doing it right? That recognition that what you set in place at one time might not work in another time. A country evolves, people evolve. And so that rebellion that Jefferson referred to was going back and taking a look and saying at a regular basis, he said about every 20 years, talked about watering with the blood of patriots. I think that was a little, you know, kind of a gothic notion, but the basic concept is about every 20 years, stop and take a look. Is the republic functioning? Is it working? And if it's not, do something about it. So let's do it. Okay, let's pull the brake. Let's stop. Let's stop right here in the basement of 57th Street Books in Chicago, Illinois, a great middle of America city, and ask ourselves, is the democratic experiment working? Because this is not a discussion about journalism. This is not a discussion about newspapers or media. This is a discussion about democracy. Is the democratic experiment working? Do we have a broad enough media gathering all of our information? Are journalists out there really doing it with the resources they need to give us what we need as citizens? Is our media system working? And if it's not, what should we do about it? Okay, how's it working? Let's take a look. Well, we know that television news gives us just about everything we could possibly need, right? You know, let's be clear. If you watch the evening news tonight, you are going to know more about the weather than anybody on your block, right? Because they're going to tell you, the average evening newscast has 7 minutes of weather. 7 minutes of weather in a 21-minute newscast. So one-third weather. Now, you say to yourself, wow, that's a lot of weather. But you need to know that in Hyde Park it was 41 degrees today, whereas downtown it was 40, right? And you need to know that the humidity was this. I don't know what humidity is, but I just know that we're going to know a lot about it, right, by the end of the weather. And you need to know that there's a weather system developing out in the west that might come here or might go to Canada, depending on how the wind blows. You need to know all that stuff. And they tell you 7 minutes of it. This is subsidized journalism, subsidized by the government of the United States. Because the government has a National Weather Service that gets all that information. They don't do any journalism to do the weather. The weather comes free. And that's why they put 7 minutes of it on, because they can make a lot of money selling ads around it, right? And you think you've got information. That's not information. That's gossip. It was a degree colder down in Hyde Park than it was downtown. That's gossip. That's not information. So once you get done with the weather, though, you're going to get the hard news, right? Crime.
Right.
Because we have got to know about crime. Now, you know, the fact of the matter is anybody who watches the evening news is more fearful of crime than all of their neighbors. If you don't watch the news, you have a rational perspective on crime in your neighborhood. If you watch it, you are afraid. Now, this confirms the thought that watching the news makes you stupider than if you don't watch the news. Now, any sort of media system that makes you stupider by consuming it than if you don't consume it is a bad media system per se. So, once you get done with the crime, though, and they give you a lot of that, because crime is also free. Crime is subsidized by the government. And so crime tells you that the police say these are the problems, these are who we arrest, and most of the time, they don't even send a camera out to show you the crime. They just tell you the crime occurred, right? So that's crime. That's another good portion of it. And then, once you're really scared of the weather or the crime, so you don't go out, you sit in front of the TV all the time and you get fat. So then, they have this creation, news you can use. They give you tips on how to exercise and lose weight, right? So, they get a lot of that. And then, if you are still fat, then they put on a video news release from a pharmaceutical company trying to sell you a new drug that will make you thin. And by then, you've done your 21 minutes, the evening news is done, and you know everything you know, need to know to be a citizen.
Right.
The only thing worse is radio. Right? Radio used to be great, very democratic medium, except now, our radio stations across this country, right? We've lost, since the Telecommunications Act of 1996, allowed one company to own as many stations as they want. One of these companies, Clear Channel, owns about 1,200 radio stations across the country. That's more than you can listen to at one time. So we busted out all the rules, said you can buy as much as you want. Now, when you spend all that money buying it, how are you going to pay off your investors? Oh, I know. Lay off all the personalities. Since 1996, we've laid off roughly 20,000 on-air radio personalities, news people, commentators, local disc jockeys. Everybody who makes radio work is gone. Now, Rush Limbaugh is everywhere, right? Rush Limbaugh is nationwide. But you know, there are stations all over this country that play 3 hours of Rush Limbaugh and no local news. Now you ask yourself, who's giving people the news now? It's not somebody gathering information. It's not a journalist. It's somebody taking what they want to tell you and frame it. My goodness, are we thinking about the king here? Right? King gets the information, sets the form of the debate. Yeah. So there we go. At least we got the newspaper, though. Thank heavens that the newspapers are still strong. Still booming, going great. Everything is fine. Because things are so great. Last year, 140 newspapers across the country closed. Mm-hmm. And that's not the scary part. We have a newspaper death watch. We're waiting for the next one. Oh, you may be a winner in Chicago. Both the Sun-Times and the Tribune are in the running. Although it looks like San Francisco's ahead, Boston's doing good, and there's even talk that the New York Times could fail. Now this is an incredible. I know this woman's like, what? It's a very bad situation we're talking about. I'm not kidding. And this is the really scary part. It's not the ones that are closing and that are talking about closing. It's the ones that are still trying to stay open. That's really scary because they're laying off journalists like you wouldn't believe. Last year. In fact, the last 2 years, newspapers have laid off employees at a rate of 1,000 or more per month. We have lost 30,000 newspaper employees in America over the last 2 years. 30,000 newspaper employees. Washington bureaus are closing at a rate of one a week. International news coverage by American newspapers, we have half as many correspondents as we had 10 years ago. The collapse is surreal. It has never happened. No democracy in the world, no country in the history of the world has had this culling of journalists. Not a dictatorship. They re-educate the journalists and put them to work in a dictatorship. Here, we lay them off. And so we end up in this situation now where we have journalism disappearing. Now, what does that mean in a community across this country? Let's not just think about it in the big picture, because it's not a Washington thing. There'll always be somebody that shows up for the president's press conference. What about our communities across the country? Let's talk about Baltimore, Maryland. Pew Center just did a great study out of Baltimore. They said, you know, where do original news come from? Where do the stories come from? Who's gathering the news in our community? And it was a very liberal study. They looked at all the possible ways that you could get information. They were studying what they called the news ecology. It was this very, you know, everything you could do, very touchy-feely, right? They studied newspaper, radio, television, blogs, internet websites, Twitter, tweets they studied from the police department. If the police department arrest somebody, they would tweet, "We arrested a guy." They studied that as an original news source. Say it all, here's what they found. Most of the news, the overwhelming majority, still comes from old media, particularly the Baltimore Sun newspaper, which is a classic old Chicago Tribune-style daily newspaper. But the Baltimore Sun's news production, the stories that they were actually, original news stories they're putting in their paper, was down 33% over the last 10 years, down 73% since 1990. 73% drop in the last 20 years in production of stories by the primary source. Now, you say, well, that's okay, because we got the internet now. Oh, the internet, fabulous, right? Because it's doing, you know, it's now, just to tell you quickly, the internet did not cause the crisis for newspapers. The crisis for newspapers was caused by big corporations buying up newspapers across the country for more than they could pay. And then, when there was a little bit of turbulence in the economy, a little bit of competition, advertising kind of moved away, they still had to pay their stockholders 30, 40% profit. To do that, to try and get that money, you have to get rid of your human costs. That's journalists. That's why this is happening, the primary reason. It's the internet may have accelerated a problem, but that problem started long before. So, okay. How much is the internet filling the void, though? Because we do have the internet. It's all those tubes and things. And I don't know how it works, but it's very interesting. Well, 4%. According to this study, 96% of the original news stories in Baltimore are still coming from old media, newspaper, radio, television. Only 4% being generated by their internet news sites, blogs, tweets, the whole bit. Now, it's not that people aren't working hard on the internet. It's just that when you have two jobs, and then when you come home and put your kids to sleep, and you start at 11:30, it's unlikely that you're going to do a lot of original news. You're going to comment, maybe, but that actually ability to go out and do journalism doesn't exist on the internet. The resources are not there. And so, 96% old media still producing original news, 4% new media, and then here's a scary thought, because none of that's scary. None of that really matters. This is what matters. They say, well, what's the source? Where does the story come from? You know, what's the, where's it generated? This is a very easy way to understand. There's two ways that information comes to people. One is this wonderful woman here says to this young journalist here, says, there is a toxic waste dump in Hyde Park. Kids are getting sick. I'm seeing a lot of bad stuff happen. I tried to call the mayor, tried to call the alderman, nothing happened. You're a journalist, go out, write about it. And you say, well, that's a tip. I'm going to check that out. So she goes and she, you know, in the daytime, because it's your job, right? You get to do this in the daytime. You don't have to call the mayor at 11:30. And you do this, you go out, you gather information, you get official records, you analyze it, you interview people, you talk to people, you get it all together, find out, yes, there is this. And then you go and speak truth to power. You actually go and say to the mayor or to powerful people, there's something wrong here. Something has to be done about it. That's what we think of as classic journalism coming up from the grassroots. Something happened above us. We're very excited. Now, classic journalism coming up from the grassroots. Now, here's the other way that it works. Here's the other way that it works. Power decides what it wants you to talk about. Remember we talked about the king? Remember? So power decides, this is the framework of the debate. These are the issues that we are going to discuss. This is how it's going to happen. Now, that's a public relations. It's the mayor talking. It's whoever, the CEO, whoever's got power. So what did Pew find in Baltimore? 86% of the original news stories were produced by power. 14% by what we would think of as journalism. 86% power. Because remember, fewer stories being produced, internet not filling the void. It's power speaking and then just being repeated stenographically. Now, Baltimore is America. In our book we show that in 1960, we had a one-to-one ratio of public relations people to journalists. Today, we have a 4-to-1 ratio of public relations people to journalists. The void is there, there's no question of that, but that void is being filled by power. And that's the crisis we live in. If George Orwell came along today, George Orwell would say to you, said, I was a fool. I thought that the big scary future was Big Brother is watching you. It turns out the really scary future is you watching Big Brother. 24/7, round the clock, a manufactured picture of news that in fact is power speaking to you the same way the king once did, telling you what you should think, what you should talk about, what you should debate, what the parameters of our discourse would be. And that's the moment we find ourselves in. That's the crisis. And we take as our subtitle a phrase from Tom Paine, the journalist who called America into being. The founder who actually was against slavery. The founder who actually thought that maybe women should be allowed to vote. The good founder, who called us into being. Tom Paine said a crisis is a good thing. A crisis is what we look for because it tells us we are sick, we are unhealthy, and we respond to the crisis. And he says that we don't respond by recreating that which is collapsing. We celebrate the change as good news, and we say we have it in our power to begin the world over again. This crisis of old media is an opportunity, an opening for us to create a new media, a new journalism that is freer, that is better, that is more dissenting, and that will give us more authority over our own lives than we have ever had. And it will give us more democracy. That's why this moment of crisis is actually something we need to embrace, not run from, not mourn, but run to it and get involved. This is our activism, more necessary than ever.
That was journalist John Nichols, co-author with Robert McChesney of the book The Death and Life of American Journalism, who spoke at 57th Street Books on March 4th, 2010. Listen to all past episodes of The Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.